This is Scott Allen from odecoded.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Coon from lazycoder.com.
All right, welcome to this week's edition of Herding Code. Tonight our guests are Jeremy Miller and Chad Myers. Jeremy is the Shade Tree developer. He's a blogger at codebetter.com, also the author of Structure Map, which was the first dependency injection framework that I ever came across. He's an MVP and an MSDN magazine columnist, too. Chad Myers is a senior .NET software developer, a community leader in the Austin area. I know he's run a couple TDD coding dojos, and he's also set up this neat concept of a virtual alt.NET meeting that meets on, I think it's every Wednesday night. So the two of you guys put something out on Google Code recently called FUBU MVC. And the FUBU stands for Us, By Us. So we wanted to talk to you a little about that. First of all, why take something based on the ASP.NET MVC framework and put it out there for other people to use?
I'll go real quick. We should be clear. It's not actually based on the ASP.NET MVC. It uses the routing engine that's in the BCL, and after that, we're going off in our own direction.
So some of this started from a project that you guys did called Opinionated MVC. Maybe you guys can give a little bit of the sort of the backstory there and the history and how that sort of evolved into FUBU.
So at Dovetail Software, we started a new web-based project. And at this point, we're pretty sure we didn't want to use web forms. And MVC had already, I believe it was in preview 2 at that point, just coming up on preview 3. And so we started using that, and we quickly started kind of rubbing against the edges a little bit. There was a lot of stuff we liked, a lot of stuff we didn't like, and some stuff that actually roadblocked us. At the time, with Preview 3, there was a lot of testability issues. They've since fixed a number of them, and we've actually at Dovetail upgraded to, I believe we're on Beta 1 now, which is I think is the current, correct me if I'm wrong. But as we went through, we started replacing things. They had a controller factory, so you could use an IOC container for the controller factory and numerous other things. But we still bumped into there was various context objects, a view context, a controller context, this context and that context, which were all abstract-based classes for the most part, which had constructors, which required more abstract-based classes. And it was kind of a rat hole that we got into. And so we started finding clever ways of getting around that. We saw the HTML helpers, and we were trying to do some view testing and ran into problems with a lot of the HTML helpers. So we started doing some of our own HTML stuff. And after a while, we quickly found out that we actually didn't have much of ASP.NET MVC left. There was the action result stuff we actually really liked. So we're still using that. But we had replaced, 80, 90% of the ASP, either replaced or just aren't using and kind of went off in a different direction. And so we started playing with it a little bit and just kind of in our free time started kicking some things around. We realized, hey, we're actually not that far from really just kind of writing our own MVC framework that's has some different qualities, which I'm sure we'll get to later in this podcast. And so we just kind of went from there and said, well, what would happen if we just kind of went all the way, turn it up to 11 and kind of went full bore on that. And so Opinionated MVC was basically where that went. We ran into some problems with copyright, I guess you might call it. Our employer was a little uncomfortable about us just releasing some of the source we had. So we decided to kind of take the knowledge we had and start from scratch and start building from there. A lot of this came out of KaizenConf. We did a presentation called Using and Abusing ASP.NET MVC for Fun and Profit, I think was the official title, where we basically talked about some of the more opinionated ways that we're using ASP.NET MVC. A lot of this, like Jeremy said, is made possible due to the fact that the routing engine, which really opens a lot of avenues up that weren't possible in ASP.NET web forms. And so that was really the kind of the catalyst that once we had that was the kind of the key that allowed us to go off and do it. Because dealing with routing and string parsing and URL parsing is not fun or easy business. There is no fun or profit in that. And so once they put that in the BCL, then we could really take off.
Well, it wasn't just the routing as well. And I'll point, in terms of influence, it wasn't just that we hit problems with the MVC. The MVC's really fine the way it is. We wanted to take off and work in a little bit different way. We wanted to actually kind of maximize our ability to use static typing a little bit more. So we got heavier and heavier into trying to use expressions to declare, you know, I want a text box for this property. And then that would carry all the metadata that's available through reflection attributes. All the information is there and available, and we can use that to kind of more intelligently make things happen. And then on the other side, we were very heavily influenced by Ruby on Rails. Lots of people have tried to copy Ruby on Rails into Java and .NET, and it never quite works because Ruby on Rails depends on Ruby's dynamic language qualities. So instead, we've tried to heavily use the .NET 3.5 capabilities, generics, expressions, using Lambda expressions, starting to do some fluent interface stuff. A lot of capabilities that just simply weren't possible 2 years ago. And we didn't feel that the MVC out of the box makes enough usage of some of this stuff.
So you mentioned strong typing as one of your sort of driving design points. What are some other key design points that you guys are really targeting for this?
Well, I think the biggest issue, and I think Chad will agree with me on this one because I hear him rant about it in the office all the time, we're aiming for more composition over inheritance. Trying to get services down to the roles. We are building from the ground up, assuming that there's an IOC tool of some kind in there. And now that the common service locator facade is available, it's much easier to swap and replace containers, so we don't have to lock you into that. But by deciding right off the bat that everything is going to be assembled by an IOC container, now we can start to talk about having smaller, finer-grained services, and we get away from that kind of nasty context hub object pattern that the MVC got into, and I think that monorail suffers from a little bit as well. The next big thing I think we're doing, the thing that I personally didn't like about the MVC framework, is I don't think it does a very good job of shielding more and more of your code away from the HTTP context objects. The HTTP context objects, they're all softly typed dictionaries. They're very hard to mock and stub, or you can do it. You're just going to type a lot of keystrokes. So instead, we've tried to isolate that and put that stuff kind of in a corner so that as much of the code as possible is strongly typed, plain old CLR objects, easy to set up, easy to test. And we'll just try to hide that kind of unmaintainable, untestable, annoying code in the smallest corner of the closet that we can.
One of the things to kind of piggyback on what Jeremy was saying, I know he said I'd like to go on rants about this, but the composition versus inheritance, you know, I mentioned something about the context classes, and I really think that the ASP.NET frame, and I'm not going to presume the constraints under which they designed the framework, and that's kind of why I like the name FUBU MVC, because it's not saying that the MVC framework is bad. It's not saying that, you know, we just take some different opinions about how frameworks should be designed, and so we would like to go with that. And we disagree with some of the choices the ASP.NET MVC framework made, so we wanted to kind of explore, okay, what if you didn't do it that way? What if you did it a different way? And I've designed a few frameworks in my time. I know Jeremy's done even more. And I keep coming back to every time that I involve the IOC container and I allow the IOC container do more of the framework or control, not control, I shouldn't say that. Well, I guess it is an inverse control, but to handle more of the brokering of objects around in the framework and how things are plugged into each other, the things just generally flow better and I have more options to maneuver around, and that the support of the framework actually gets easier, being able to add new features, remove features that are no longer used, or be able to, you know, kind of phase them out. Those sorts of things get a lot easier. And when I used to design frameworks more inheritance-based, which is, I would call kind of more the classic .NET model, heavily inheritance-based, heavily abstract class-based, enforcing inheritance model. It really limits your maneuverability and really forces you into a complicated support situation where you're really having to manage your methods, your method signatures very, very clean. I mean, using composition over inheritance doesn't solve all those problems, but it certainly makes it easier because you can obsolete things easier and point people to different services while still supporting the other ones without having to basically burn the whole inheritance tree if you need to change something drastically.
Right. So I'm curious, what are some things that you used your dependency injection framework for or your container for that might not be obvious, or you know, something that you discovered you could use it for that other than like, you know, for your controllers?
Well, controllers, yeah, that's a big thing. So here's a small one, and I think I'm going to have a blog example of this soon, but a lot of controller actions return objects, and honestly, we let our domain model objects flow out of our controllers or come through the model that comes out of the controller action. It's convenient. It's easy. We control the code on both sides. It's not hurting us to couple that. But in other cases, we're doing a lot of JSON services, a lot of Ajaxy stuff with jQuery. And it's very inappropriate to try to serialize our domain model objects to something the JavaScript is going to handle, either because we're worried about coupling or because it's just not in a shape that the JavaScript serializer can handle. So what we need to do is to what we call flatten it. Take any given object and flatten it into something that's a DTO or something that's JSON friendly. So one of the tricks we can do is we have this interface called iFlattener of T, where T is whatever the concrete type is you want to flatten it. So we use some dependency injection tricks to say, I have this object, go find me the iFlattener of whatever this type happens to be. I get that, and then I can use it to turn it into a JSONable object. So I have a single point to go in and say, just turn this into JSON for me right now. So transfer it to a completely different object, and then I'll JSON it. And that's enabled us to make a very generic, what we call the JSON handler. So we can attach it to the backside of any controller action and more or less handle anything coming down the turnpike. If we don't have a specific JSON handler for it, then it just returns the same object and off you go, and everything's happy. So it just kind of gives us a special ability to plug in special JSONifiers and handle that from the container so it's all transparent.
So a little bit back, you mentioned the idea of composition over inheritance, which goes back to the idea of, you know, really using object-oriented programming. And that kind of that goes back to the principle of SOLID, which is kind of key, I think, to some of the design principles you're looking at. I wonder if one of you guys could just kind of go through SOLID and explain what that is.
Looking at it in terms of a controller action. So let's take the S. The S in SOLID stands for, and correct me if I'm wrong, the single responsibility principle. And all it really means is, or to say it academically, a class, an object, should only have one reason to change. It only does one thing. There's only one class, one responsibility, however you want to put it. So a big refactoring we made about a month ago. If you think about the pipeline of a request coming through MVC, it's I get some HTTP stuff sent up. I basically get a bunch of name value pairs in the request.form coming up to a URL. So the routing does its magic and hands off in our world to what's called a URL handler. The URL handler has a couple things to do. After that, you have to take the HTTP input, the stuff coming from request.form, the query string, the routing collection, and we need to turn that into the input object that's going to go into our controllers. One of our opinions is that the controllers will always take a strongly typed object in and return a strongly typed object out. No dictionaries, no magic strings. So something's got to turn that data into the class or object that our controller action needs. So that turns out to be one responsibility all by itself. So we have a class on the outside of the controllers that can do that. And what that means is our controller doesn't have to know anything about the HTTP context stuff at all. And that's helped to make our controllers thinner and a lot easier to deal with because we can test them independently of the HTTP context junk. On the other side, then the next responsibility is just simply the controller does whatever it does. Controller's job is to take a model coming in, delegate to something to other helper services if it needs to, but in the end it needs to return another model. And this model object should be a dumb package of data that the view can then render. So as the model comes out, we needed to do something with it. Either turn it into JSON, go find a web forms view, activate it, pass the model through, all kinds of other things. When we got into the system, we originally had a class that kind of did two or three things, and we started exploding combinations of what we needed to do. Run this controller action, turn it into JSON, but look for a redirect. But no, now we're going to turn it into RSS instead, and all this other stuff going on. So what we decided was simply handling the output of a controller was an opinion all by itself. So once we kind of went to that, we created a new class called Model Handler that just did something with a model object coming out of a controller and turned it into an action result. By making that its own little responsibility all by itself and following SRP, then we could start to swap it in and out with other ones, which gets you to the O in Solid, I guess, the open-close principle. Software should be open for extension, but closed for modification, which just roughly means that we should be able to make the code do new things without having to scroll around and change existing code. So for us, we're going to put in an RSS feature this week. And we should be able to do that by just creating a new RSS special model handler and plugging it into our system without changing any of the rest of the code, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. I'm just curious, how does the model handler know what to do? Is it gleaning stuff from HTTP headers or...
No, they're very specialized. I mean, they're very okay. Tiny. So when we say okay. SRP, we're taking it very seriously.
Okay. You mentioned the WebForms view engine. Did you evaluate any of the other view engines? Are you happy with WebForms view engine?
Recently, somebody submitted a patch to FUBU MVC for the Spark view engine, which looks particularly interesting. I had a chance to just play very quick with it, or I only had a small chance to play with it just for a short period of time. I haven't actually committed it yet. I do plan on doing so. So Spark looks interesting. I played around a little bit with nVelocity, which was all right. It works, obviously. I'm not saying anything bad about it. But it's really hard for me to give up the candy of, you know, the syntax highlighting and everything in Visual Studio that I get with ASPX and ASCX files. And it also happens to just be a familiarity thing for me. I know how to work around those things. I know how to render user controls directly without going through the whole page pipeline and all that sort of thing. So it's easy for me to do partials and implement that functionality pretty quick.
The one thing I would say about the WebForms engine, I wouldn't say we're thrilled with it. I know in terms of testability, it was a little messy to deal with. One of the things we wanted to do, because I've always admired Rails capabilities in this regard, was to say, I have a view, and if I pass this lump of data into it, now I want to make some assertions on what happened. You know, if the model property is this text showing up, is this hidden, is this displayed, stuff that's very specific view logic. I had a lot of fighting and wrestling to make the WebForms engine kind of behave. But from our side, we depend so heavily on that kind of text4 strongly typed expression HTML creation that the IntelliSense and being able to put the step in the build that compile the ASPX code to see if there's any problems. That's so valuable for us that it's going to be hard to move off. But I would definitely keep an eye on Spark or Enhamel or some of the others.
A key point about that, the reason we do the TextBox 4 and we have a pretty strong stance against no magic strings, or at least no magic strings that reference code elements that can change, you know, property names and method names and that sort of thing, is so that we can have refactoring support. And ReSharper, for example, is a product that we use that's attached to Visual Studio, allows us to go into one of our view models or a controller and change a method name, you know, just by hitting F2, typing a new name and hitting go, and it will go into the views and update them there if a particular view model property name or something is referenced by a view. And that's really powerful. We're not using dictionaries with magic strings, you know, the whole view data magic bag business, which on previous projects that I've worked on, not with ASP.MVC, but with similar frameworks that pass dictionaries around, you get into trouble with that pretty quick in any sufficiently large project.
Well, remember the messes we made in ASP Classic when we did stuff like that. That's
scripting.dictionary, baby.
Yeah, I'm not sure a lot of people might be familiar with TextBox 4. Could you drill into that a little bit?
I'll take it to begin with. So I think especially for people coming from web forms to MVC, I know one of the complaints I've heard that seems pretty reasonable on the face of it is I lose data binding. How am I going to reliably synchronize data from server to client controls to hit the request to come back up and turn that into my right business objects? Is that fair enough, you think?
Yes.
So our text box, the way we do text boxes, we don't do any HTML like by hand that way. We would say text box 4, this is in the view code, which is strongly typed. Mm-hmm. So I would say text box 4, and I would use an expression and specify what the property name is of the model I want to use. X dot X, the lambda symbol, X dot address 1, right? The first text line in an address field. So the text box expression sees that and says, I'm going to parse the expression. I'm going to find the name of the property, address 1. And I'm going to use that as a convention. I'm going to name the text box that. And then I'm also going to use that expression. I'm going to compile it to the func. And then I can go get the property value off of my model object and use that to fill the text box. Okay, that's the most simple usage. On the way back up, because we have this is enforcing a very strict naming convention, it's pretty easy to go from the dictionary of request stuff and then turn that back into an object, which we use a DTO. We don't bind it directly to the domain model coming in. Mm-hmm. But that makes screen synchronization relatively easy. It gives us de facto data binding. So that's one issue. And then maybe kind of going back to the discussion of solid, skip all the way to the D, don't repeat yourself. Early on, you know, we're just concentrating on making it work. We're trying to just get very basic, get data access flowing, get the data forms going. Then later we want to start getting fancy. We want to start wanting to say, I want to apply client-side validation, right? So in our case, we use attribute-based validation for the really stupid, silly things like this is a required field, or this date must be after today, or this field has a maximum string length of, 25, 50. So those attributes are decorating the properties that we're binding to. So we had this text box expression. All text boxes are built this way. So I can just kind of calmly go into the text box expression class and make it a little bit smarter. Make it smart enough to recognize this required attribute or this maximum length attribute and build the text box expression up a little bit differently, right? Mm-hmm. So in one step, by just changing this text box expression, I've suddenly added client-side validation everywhere. Now, there's a little more magic. We use the jQuery validation, and that's applied through a master page effect. So by making very few changes, we've been able to make that impact every which way because we're using the exact little piece of code to write text boxes everywhere. So that kind of thing has been very valuable. That's one of the criticisms you see about the MVC is the idea that, oh, I'm going to have to repeat all this work and write all this stuff by hand. And by being very aggressive about these HTML helpers and HTML expressions, you can take a lot of that work down, and then you can also make it easier for yourself to go with a fancier model or make a more elaborate user experience later on.
That sounds pretty incredible. So I'm guessing, if someone comes up to you and says, hey, I need to add this field to, this particular domain object, you probably add that one field there and maybe add a field to a DTO and maybe add one of these expression-based for you statements into a view, and everything else just flows out of that, the binding, the validations.
Yes. Well, that's the goal.
Right.
Now we do have a little special little bit of code generation to code generate the DTOs off of our domain objects. So it gives you a flattened DTO. It was a very well. Anyway, it wasn't Chad and I's best week, the week that we figured all this stuff out. But it works now, and we're never going to change it ever again.
Yeah. Well, what do you think if you took the average number of lines of code in your controller methods, what would that be?
Do you think, Chad, 5 or 6?
If you say the average, I would say the vast majority of them only have a few lines of code, but there's a few ones which I'm not particularly proud of, but what can you do?
Sure. Well, we'll discard the outliers.
I can vouch for you too. I'm checking your code as we're on the call, and yeah, I'm seeing tiny controllers, which is awesome. So.
Oh yeah, well we're not making this stuff up on the fly. That's all this MVC stuff. Other communities have been there first, and the Rails guys and the MERB guys are just screaming on that thin controller, fat model worldview. But what I think we found out by what we call the Thunderdome principle or the Highlander principle, the always must be one strong model in, one strong type model out. Our controller methods turn into not much more than return new and an object initializer. And we think that's been kind of a nice idiomatic thing to do, because everything, all the controller is really doing for the most part in a lot of views is just returning that model. So start your object initializer and build it up and return, and away you go.
I don't want to beat a dead horse if nobody else cares. I think we went through we covered all the kind of solid stuff, and I don't know how important that is. I think that it's something that some people that listen to the show might not have ever heard of. We did, I think, S, O, and D. So we did the SOD, and I was wondering if anyone wanted to quickly do the L and I in there. Liskov, baby.
Okay, I'll take them both if you don't mind, Chad.
Yeah. Go for it.
Because I've got something sarcastic when we get to ISP. So the middle one, the Liskov, hope I didn't pronounce that wrong. What's the rest of it, guys?
Liskov substitution principle.
Yeah, so, I like to put a European twist on it. Liskov.
So what it means, it's kind of a fundamental OO thing. It's basically specifying how polymorphism is supposed to work. If I have an interface of any kind or an abstract class, if I'm following LSP, I should be able to cleanly substitute any concrete type of an interface anywhere where that interface is expected. So what this means is that anybody who is using or consuming that interface must only be treating that interface kind of at face value, at what the contract is. It should never be downcasting iController to controller base. The MVC framework actually violates this a touch, we found out later. I should never be downcasting. I should never be assuming some kind of internal knowledge of what it does. Sam Gentile told me a great story about this one time. A team that he was either working with or knew of was using a web service, and it was all behind an interface, and that's all great. But the consumer of the interface knew, and I'm making finger quotes here, that the data was sorted in a certain order, and it was using that implicit knowledge to carry out its operation. But that sort order was never part of the interface contract. So if they ever switched it out and tried to use a different version, you know, a different service provider, everything would have broken because they weren't following the Liskov substitution principle. And then finally, the I is the interface segregation principle. So it's the idea that everything in an interface should be related to only related to itself. So let's say if we do have a class that does kind of do multiple things, or it's consumed in two different ways, that it has one interface for how it's consumed by in place A, and it has a different interface in class B, so that you as a user don't have to get confused when you're using an object and it has these five methods that don't apply to the way you're using it at all. Using the Entity Framework as an example, or any data access tool that generates your data objects for you, what you end up with is you theoretically have a business object that has a lot of methods around business logic, but then you also may have a couple dozen methods that are data access related. So you've got an ISP kind of violation. You can't look at it as a business object or a data object at one time. You pretty well have to look at it together, and that can kind of cause some friction in how you use a class.
All right, just to get a different perspective on things, is FUBU MVC, is that something that you see other people downloading and building applications on, or did you intend it merely as a reference?
I would hope so eventually. It's not quite exactly there yet. There's still a few key things. One of the key motivators right now, at least for me personally, that's kind of spawned some development on the framework, is the recent Oxite flare-up. We can go into that if you want some more background on that for your listeners, but hopefully if they're listening to this podcast, they're probably already aware of the background there. And so when I saw that application, I thought, oh, here's an opportunity to kind of, you know, not just point out what's wrong, but show, you know, like here's something that I didn't particularly like about Oxite. How would I approach that differently? And so rather than just going writing off a separate application, I thought I would also combine that with driving out the FUBU MVC framework. So it's actually worked out pretty well so far. It's actually flushed out several issues with the framework and helped kind of push it along a little bit. It's also drawn the attention of several other participants. So I've actually been getting a lot more patches, and we've even got a new contributor now who's really just been banging things up. I don't know if he wants me to mention his name. I can ask him later. Maybe we can edit this out. But it's Mark. I'm going to butcher his name. I think it's Nijoff. He's from Norway, and he's just been rocking it. So it's funny because he's actually offset, you know, by 8 or 12 hours from here in Austin. So he actually works, you know, through my night, and then sometimes I'll work during the day. So we actually got like 24-hour development going on FUBU MVC right now. I'm mostly joking. Or at least we did over the Christmas break. So,
right.
Yeah. Now I don't know if Chad completely buys off on the vision, but I'd like to see it kind of grow up into being the Ruby on Rails for .NET. And what I mean by that is not just the MVC, but the fact when you download it. So if we have this kind of opinionated structure that this is the way things are, this is how you're going to identify objects, this is how your CRUD controllers are going to look, this is the structure that's going to be there. That enables us to start doing things like adding testing tools. So you want to try out a view without running it through the controller? We got it that covered. We have a tool out of the box for that. You want a fast way of testing controller actions? You got to write your controller actions like this, and then we have a special context that makes that easy. You want to start with FUBU? Looky here. Start with FUBU. Follow the structure we set up. You get a build script out of the box that already knows how to do FUBU-specific things. Again, just like Rails. I'd almost even like to take it so far as to have like kind of accelerators for using in Hibernate or the specific IOC tools. But do that in such a way that that's kind of an optional add-in.
I really like how you're explaining this as kind of like instead of going with Rails, leveraging dynamic programming, you're using functional programming, and that gives me the static typing, which is always something, you know, that's always something I've thought as kind of a positive feature over you know, Ruby on Rails. Like, there's a lot of things that are great about Ruby on Rails, but I've just, maybe it's just my classic ASP background, but I've always just been, you know, I've been stung so many times with magic strings, and I just really would like the compiler to check as much as it can for me. That sounds like a really great approach.
And I would just like to say it is kind of a give and take, good and bad. Yeah, the static typing is awesome to find problems, but we have kind of run into limitations of C#, like places where in our CRUD controller, we have a base CRUD controller because CRUD it's always the same. I get data, apply that data to the domain object, validate it if it's validate, save it, whatever. That algorithm's exactly the same. So we have a base class and we try to reuse the algorithm, which means using a lot of generics to say, well, this is the input model, and then it has to have all these constraints. And to get that kind of reuse or in other places to get the dynamic behavior, you fall into a nasty rat hole of generics hell, where the generics just start to overwhelm things. Where, as much as I love the expressions in the .NET 3.5 GUI, I think there's still a lot of place for Ruby or Iron Ruby to maybe step in later in places where it does need to be more dynamic.
One of the things I picked up on your code base is that your generic parameters are actually complete names. They're not just the single capital letter that we're accustomed to with generics. And when I first saw that, it kind of jumped out at me as something I didn't like, but it only took about 10 or 15 seconds looking through the code, and I started to think, you know, that's not too bad. I kind of like that. It was very explicit. But I can imagine it gets noisy.
That's a common reaction. A lot of people don't like that. I'm going to call that a team quirk we have and leave it at that.
At least for me personally, when I get into code that's not written like that, and it's, you know, there's a bunch of T's and U's and K's and V's all over the place, you know, if you have just one parameter and it's T, that's not so bad. But if you have three parameters and it's T, U, K, trying to keep those straight in your mind just totally blows me away every time. And maybe that's just a limitation of my brain. But, you know, having controller input and output makes it pretty explicit what's going on, I think.
So you mentioned testing tools. What kind of testing tools you guys are using?
I'm hoping to have a much better story about this in a couple months. But for right now, we're still using NUnit for most of our unit testing. We are trying to adopt a little more of a BDD style, mostly because it just makes sense. So that covers our controller actions. We have a special view context that's really just an NUnit base class that we can use to test views. We don't use it a lot. That uses Watton for more integration tests and end-to-end web testing. We use, I'm working right now on a tool called Storyteller. I've been working on it for years, but I just started it from scratch. Storyteller is meant to be a ground-up replacement for the Fit engine, if you're familiar with that. But behind the scenes, we express the test as cleanly as we can in Storyteller, so it's all displayed as HTML, as kind of an executable spec. Behind the scenes, it's using Selenium RC to tickle the screen. Now, kind of back to that text box for, or, you know, create select box for this expression. By doing that and that, you know, enforces that rigid naming convention, we can actually express our automated tests in terms of the model properties and use those expressions in our test automation code. So that makes our automated tests much less brittle than they normally would be if you were depending on strings and ID names and all kinds of soft stuff. That's something I would like to see end up in FUBU MVC someday as well. You know, so when you download it, not only do you get all this little opinionated stuff, but, oh, here's a full-blown test automation strategy that should work if you follow our opinions.
And did you run into any problems with the asynchrony of your views?
Oh, yeah. Now, there is stuff in Selenium RC to do the whole wait until this thing happens. So again, to the idea of the solid stuff, the don't repeat yourself. We have a common library that we use to do all AJAX-type communication. We call it Window Manager, but it wraps the jQuery calls. And because it's the only thing that's making the calls, We only have one place that we need to trap the asynchronous event coming back. So you can do things like having a hidden div field somewhere so that you can change the text in it to say, you know, I'm waiting for something or complete. And then your Selenium RC stuff has a common way to know if the page is busy or not. I'm not saying the asynchronous stuff is easy, but that's a way to get around that stuff.
If we could do an aside real quick, I was going to say there were a few particularly interesting things in FUBU MVC that I'm particularly proud of. Jeremy touched on them a little bit. We have something similar at Dovetail, which, by the way, when we're talking about some of this stuff, we kind of go back and forth of what we're doing at Dovetail and what we're doing in FUBU MVC, which is not necessarily exactly the same thing. Remember, like I said, we couldn't take the Dovetail code and just put it out open source. So
right.
These are kind of essentially two, I don't even want to say forked code bases. They're basically parallel code bases. So we kind of mix and match a little bit. But So back to FUBU MVC, you know, I mentioned composition versus inheritance earlier, and Jeremy's talked about kind of the chain of responsibility we have. So FUBU MVC has basically controllers do not require you to implement anything. Basically, it's a POCO class with a method that follows the one model in, one model out, Thunderdome, Highlander pattern, whatever you want to call it. And so as long as you just have that a method with that pattern, it can be a controller. And then the configuration is all conventional based. You basically tell it, all my controllers are in this namespace, or all my controllers are in this assembly in this namespace. All my controllers have the name, have the suffix controller in them, you know, and then all the methods, all the public methods basically in there become. And then what that allows us to do is that you can do some pretty interesting things with that. So you basically mix in behavior. It's not quite the mixing concept you have in Ruby. I don't want to go that far, but or I would like to go that far, but you can't in C# necessarily. But because we're using a chain of responsibility to execute those actions, you can actually layer in behavior. So, for example, in FUBU MVC, actually in Alt Oxite, which is kind of that sample project that's driving the FUBU MVC framework. It's a separate project, but it's within the same solution to keep things simple. We have a behavior called accesses the database through a unit of work. So this behavior essentially wraps the entire request. And if you've ever used something like in Hibernate, for example, and used the session per request pattern, you know that you usually have to implement an HTTP module that traps the before request and after request that handles grabbing the session and ending the session. And there isn't a real you may have run into problems occasionally because it's not a real definite try finally. So there are circumstances where you can actually get into a situation where it doesn't actually close the session. It's very rare, and you know, it'd have to be like an error situation. But with the chain of responsibility pattern in FUBU MVC, you can actually hook the entire request, wrap a try catch or a try finally around the whole thing, and do a real unit of work with the using keyword in C# for our C# listeners. You know, and you can actually hook the whole thing and do a real unit of work pattern, which is really neat. And then you can lay on a whole bunch of other behavior. You can lay on output caching. You can layer on. For example, we have certain orthogonal concerns, but basically every request uses the ASP.NET view and the web forms view engine, which has master pages. And in the header of the master page, it says whether you're logged in or not. Every request that renders a view needs that. Well, rather than copying that into every controller, or for example, putting that into a base class and doing inheritance, we layer on a behavior. So the behavior has a single responsibility, that particular behavior or chain and the responsibility in the chain of responsibilities has that one responsibility. Go see if the user's logged in, and if he is or she is, set that property on the view model. And then particular controller actions don't need to worry about that. In fact, they shouldn't be worrying about that because that's not their responsibility. And back to a little bit about what Jeremy was saying, where, you know, like if we can turn FUBU and MVC into some best practices, but we could also collect some of these behaviors because accesses the database through a unit of work has absolutely nothing to do or is not specific to Alt Oxite. It could be used in any project. So there's an example of one type of best practice that we can start encapsulating in the framework.
So I wanted to make a little point about the conventions. There's something I'm seeing, what I think is a very positive trend showing up with a lot of our .NET frameworks, and I don't know, maybe the rest of the world. So we're talking about all this, the composable pipeline of how do I handle the HTTP stuff coming in and turn to an object, how does it invoke the controller, and then what happens after. You know, all of that is by little objects that have to be composed together to make something happen. That's kind of a runtime model. That's getting close to what Martin Fowler is calling the semantic model, the classes that actually do something. Chad mentioned conventions, using conventions to hook up controller actions to what they do. The real magic happens in the semantic models. So the conventions are just building up these semantic models. So what we can do is we can have convention-based stuff, but you can also have explicit configuration where you're kind of building that model up yourself with a fluent interface that's hopefully usable. But the cool thing is I think we're going to be able to support pluggable conventions. You're going to be able to create your own conventions or your own policies. You know, something like saying all the controller actions that are named, that where the name matches this predicate on a string, these are always JSON actions that can only be handled with the get keyword. So you could make your own convention-based stuff. Any way possible to reduce the explicit configuration, but not get into the Rails problems that people were complaining about a couple years ago, where if you didn't like the Rails conventions, you were kind of up a creek. So, but that's something, I mean, that's something StructureMap supports. It's something that Windsor supports. It's something I'm seeing show up more and more in our .NET tooling.
Interesting. Yeah, when I was looking through the code, I thought it was interesting. I saw a couple lines somewhere. The first one was instantiating a new FUBU convention, and then the line right after that was instantiating a new FUBU configuration, or maybe it was pulling it from containers, but it was literally convention over configuration, number one, then number two. Going back to what Chad was talking about, if I'm understanding this correctly, if I had a web page that was a little more compositional in nature, that's been a problem that some people have run into with MVC, and there's various solutions to this partial rendering that some people would talk about. Is that something I could do with behaviors?
Yeah, well, FUBU, MVC, there's several examples of this in Oxide, as a matter of fact. There is partial rendering, which at this point, since FUBU, MVC, at this point only uses web forms. I have examples of doing partial rendering, and there's nothing specifically tying it to web forms. It's just all I've done so far. You can do partials using user controls, and then the model of the partial is based off the larger view model. So the controller sends one model to the view, and then the view can break that down into partials rather than the controller having to work or have separate controllers or smaller controllers. It basically flows down from that. And if there's any sort of compositional stuff, which I think is where you were heading, for example, our login status control at the top, I briefly touched on this. Yes, you would assign a behavior. If it's a kind of overreaching, overarching thing that happens on every sort of view or may happen on most views, you can also do it, you know, on a particular action by action basis. Like this action is going to also need these things. And I can do that from the configuration, and I don't have to do it from within the code of the action. So if this action is used in two different contexts, and when a request comes in this way for it, or with this URL, you do this particular thing. And if it comes in this way with this URL, you can do that particular thing. You would layer different behaviors on top of that action, so the controller didn't have to worry necessarily, or you might put in the controller. I mean, it depends on your context, but you have options there. That's kind of the point.
Now, getting back to the old dynamic versus static typing, that this is where open classes would be nice, as you need to progressively add more data to the model. But kind of going back to the view, composable view, and using partials, I mean, one of our philosophies is to put as little flow control as possible into the views. These need to be as dirt simple as possible. So in a lot of cases, for show this if this condition or run a loop or the repeater, you know that tag soup problem that a lot of people are complaining about? Rob Connery was writing about it. I think Jeff Atwood was complaining about it on Stack Overflow. We've tried as much as possible. We've tried to eliminate that in our code by using more fluent interface stuff. So if put in a predicate on the model, you know, if that's true, then render this partial, or render this enumerable property using this partial, you know, which would load a user control. So in one tight little method chaining, you know, we could basically set up our own little repeater control, and then use user controls. It's kind of like doing composed method. You know, it's like just calling off to a private method of yourself. But you can squeeze down and get rid of the tag soup problem. So the views are always going to be harder to test than controller code. So anytime you have code that's hard to test, you want to make it as small as possible, and you want to make it as easy to read as possible to eliminate the chances of mistakes, and to make it easier to remove problems just by scanning it visually. So that's one of the other things we've tried to do with the FUBU stuff.
So one thing about Alt Oxite is that you're using nHibernate, and I wondered if you could just kind of explain to some of our listeners who haven't looked at nHibernate before, you know, what are the advantages of nHibernate?
Well, particularly in FUBU MVC or Alt Oxite, particularly FUBU MVC has nothing to do with nHibernate. Let's just establish you can use it with any persistence framework you want. That's kind of the point, right? It's a separation of concerns. But for Alt Oxite, since it is an application based on the FUBU MVC framework and it needs its own persistence framework, you know, we could the Oxite project used Link to SQL, and it had some particular problems because of that. And so I wanted to try something different. And I've used nHibernate before and I'm familiar with it, so that's probably the first and primary reason. But the second reason was because I can easily get up to speed with different databases. So it's quick to use SQLite, for example, in unit testing and for just real small kind of onesie-twosie things on your local system. But then, you know, it's real easy to just turn around and point it at SQL Server. Now, you can do that with, I believe, Subsonic and a few other persistence frameworks. I don't believe you can do that with Link to SQL. I think it's explicitly tied to SQL Server, if I recall correctly. And it's just really easy to get going. I use the Fluent nHibernate project, which makes using nHibernate much easier. Fluent nHibernate is basically a Fluent interface, a sort of internal DSL on top of the configuration API for nHibernate, so you don't have to deal with as much XML, because that's been one of the weaknesses of nHibernate is having to deal with all the XML. And since we said in our views no magic strings referencing code elements, because I wanted to be refactoring, I couldn't then start using nHibernate and have all this XML that referenced code elements that wasn't subject to refactoring. So Fluent nHibernate was a big jump for us there. So I'd definitely like to plug those guys. Those guys are doing some cool stuff.
But we get a little bit of the credit for that, tiny bit.
Yeah. But I want to spread it around a little bit. Those guys are working hard, so.
Yeah, Chad and I actually wrote the initial version. So all the legacy code that the Fluent and Hibernate guys are removing or cleaning up, that was us. But same Fluent and Hibernate's the same philosophy as FUBU. Using the idiomatic C# abilities, mapping with expression, so everything's strongly typed, using a lot of convention-based mappings. Every entity has an ID property that's our primary key, so I don't want to say 50 times, 100 times that, yes, I want to use an auto number or a database assigned primary key for the ID field. That's a convention. So we specify that. Fluent nHibernate supports a lot of convention-based mappers, and then we do some of our own stuff inside of the FUBU. And that takes down some of the mechanical work of making things go. Less explicit configuration, again.
I want to go back a little bit if I can kind of switch gears. One of the things, I think somebody actually asked this question, I think, hey, Scott, you asked it, about how we're using inversion of control and what's so special about that. And I did want to talk about that from a framework design perspective, because I really hoped it would pan out. I've been talking about it. I kind of knew in my heart of hearts it would work out. I've done it on smaller projects. And I wanted to kind of really use this for, this project to kind of just totally run with it. And I think it's worked out better than my wildest dreams, better than I could have ever hoped. Pretty much everything in the FUBU MVC framework, I've tried to keep very, very small. Every service that's in the framework, the way I view the framework is a collection of services that you pull out that you need. You know, like, okay, here's a URL. I need a service to deal with the URL. Okay, the URL service has told me that here's what you need to do to execute it. Okay, I need somebody to execute this thing. Okay, go execute it. And oh, by the way, before you execute it, I need you to do some behavior stuff for, you know, basically to just keep pulling things out of the cloud, if you will, the cloud of services that are configured in the IOC container. And just for reference, I am using the Common Service Locator pattern by the, I believe that's the PMP guys. And I have examples of structure map right now, and I'm looking for people to help out with Winsor and Ninject and some of the other really good IOC containers out there. But anyway, but back to the subject, pulling services out of the cloud. And I've tried to make sure that everything as much as possible comes out of the container and is dependency injected. So if you want to write a behavior, for example, those come out of the IOC container. So if your behavior needs to have a dependency, say, on the repository and needs to access domain model objects, for example, load the current user and set his logged in status, maybe his or her, you know, full name, that sort of thing, how many new messages, private messages they have pending, that sort of stuff, where you actually need to go hit the repository and load the object or pull it out of a cache or a thing like that. You can simply put that dependency, for example, iRepository, in the constructor of your behavior, and poof, there it is. You just get it. Your controllers come out of the IOC container, whether you know it or not. You don't have to have a constructor on them. If you do put a constructor on it and you have an iRepository in your constructor, or you have some other service, either a service that's part of FUBU MVC itself, some sort of framework service, a service that's in your domain, or your application, or a third-party service that you have loaded up in your IOC container, poof, you just get it. It just works. And one of the things I've really kind of explored with this is, for example, the current unit of work. You know, I mentioned earlier that access is a database through a unit of work. Since we're doing the session per request, if the controller needs to access the unit of work, you just put unit of work in your constructor, and boom, you have the current unit of work for that request. So it's thread safe and all that. Structure map actually guarantees that, and I know some of the other containers also do that too. Also, the current, you know, for example, ASP.NET MVC has this concept of like the controller context or the action context, where if you need access to the current executing context, the HTTP context, the session, or what action am I currently executing in? You know, if you're in a behavior, you're not associated with the action. If you need to know the name of the action for whatever reason, or the URL that's currently executing, basically in your constructor, I think it's iConfiguration context. You just put that in your constructor, and boom, now you have access to that. And it's a declared dependency. So when you're testing your behavior, it's clear what's going on. It's not a opaque dependency. It's not some abstract base class that's dependent upon HTTP context that's lurking in the bowels of your code. So if you try to test it outside of the context of ASP.NET, oops, no current HTTP context. Sorry, you know, no testing for you. It's right there in the in the controller, and it's also an interface, so it's very easy to mock. If you're using a mocking framework, you can just cram it right in there.
I would still suggest, and this is just ASP.NET in general, this applies equally to web forms. I wouldn't let your controllers, or in web forms world, I wouldn't, if you're going to try to do model view presenter, don't let your presenters consume session or request or response directly.
Yeah.
Those stuff for, you know, little low-level stuff. Put a wrapper around it that turns it into the semantics of your application and makes it strongly typed. Don't try to mock something like request or form or HP context. Mocking fine-grained objects, it stinks. It'll overwhelm your tests with mocking setup. It won't be readable. Everything will hurt. People will be angry. That kind of stuff. That's when you see people screaming about, I hate this TDD stuff. It's because they've tried to do something like that sometimes. So one of the last things I think I'd like to talk about is how we're handling JavaScript. Now we're, like every right-thinking person in the world, we're using jQuery pretty heavily. I mean, I know Moo Tools is out there, and there's all kinds of other cool things like Dojo. We fell into jQuery. We love it. It's an incredibly rich ecosystem. But some of our other opinions, we're doing a lot of magic stuff with jQuery. Anything time where we need a richer user experience, or there's a lot of screen synchronization. So that gets you into a situation where you have really significant stuff happening with your JavaScript. So there's a lot of room for error. There's a lot of places where you can make mistakes. It's a dynamic language, and you know where that goes from there. So to make it more manageable, we specified a rule or an opinion, and a kind of a common one, that there will be absolutely no server-side markup in the middle of your JavaScript files. If you need to pass data from the server side into JavaScript, you somewhere in a JavaScript, in a script tag, you just simply write page level variables. And then the JavaScript can refer to those page level variables. What that does for us, enables us to package all the JavaScript into JS files, even if it's intimately coupled to a page. And once it's into files, we use the QUnit tool. That's part of, it's the XUnit unit testing tool that they use internally for jQuery development, but it's also released for us. I think it's the slickest, easiest to use JavaScript testing tool. It runs in a browser. You can run it in Firefox or IE. So we've actually found it very effective to do a lot of unit testing and even some full-blown real test-driven development with our jQuery and client-side JavaScript code, you know, which does a lot to cut down on the errors and giving you a lot more confidence in your ability to change things. One of Chad and I's coworkers, Joshua Flanagan from Los Techies as well, wrote a bridge from NUnit to QUnit using Watten, just so we can throw in more tools in there. But it's given us the ability to run all of those QUnit tests as part of our automated build. So our your normal developer builds plus the continuous integration build run all these JavaScript unit tests as well. And that's done a lot for us to reduce the number of errors and bugs in the JavaScript code and to kind of make JavaScript safe to work with.
One of the things I like particularly about jQuery is, you know, I've done a lot of JavaScript. Most of my career, my software development career, has been with web development. And I've flirted back and forth between, you know, going heavy OO and trying to build an OO framework. You know, if you think about like prototype and those types of frameworks, prototype-based or scriptaculous-based, all the way to the other extreme, which is highly procedural or semi-functional, kind of like what jQuery is. And, you know, you get into trouble with both of them where, you know, JavaScript kind of has some cool OO features but kind of falls down and you don't get some of the cool stuff that you normally get with OO. And likewise, you know, you run into problems with procedural code, classic problems with procedural code. One of the things I like about jQuery is it's basically the stuff we're doing in C# right now, putting an internal DSL on top of a semantic model. So you can do all your OO stuff that isn't really that nice to work with day in, day out, and you can put a nice fluent interface on top of it. So you can do all the heavy lifting inside your nice clean OO code in JavaScript that's easy to test and, you know, using QUnit and that sort of thing. And then just put a little bit of jQuery procedural syntactic sugar on top of it to tie it all together with a nice little bow. You kind of get the best of both worlds there.
There's kind of maybe a bigger point here, and it's something we've learned and relearned a few times when we forget to apply it, but JavaScript is fine as long as you treat it like it's grown-up programming. So reduce your duplication, pay attention to the class structure of your JavaScript, keep it clean, and unit test or TDD your JavaScript as much as you can. It's real coding. It produces real bugs. It gets real people fired. Treat it like the real thing.
So I'm wondering, you know, like if you guys can give us a call to action for day-to-day web form programmer, if you can give us some, you know, like what are my next steps and why should I do it? You know, how can I sell it to my boss?
I'll let Chad weigh in this too. I don't think that's entirely a slam dunk. I mean, from our perspective, I mean, we'll give you the standard cry that anyone else does. It's cleaner code, much cleaner code. You have much more predictability on what's happening. The test coverage is very high. I think a lot of people may not be convinced that that's valuable, but to me that actually helps our productivity and enabling us to get errors out of the code faster. You know, we're not paid to write code, we're paid to ship code. I know the MVC can look a little scary, like, oh, I'm writing so much more code, except you can stop that with judicious use of expressions and HTML helpers. The biggest thing I would say for web forms developers is don't be afraid of this thing. And go learn jQuery. Go learn a lot of jQuery, because that's jQuery, the unobtrusive JavaScript model, simple server-side markup, CSS, all the classic web development skills. I think it's just so much cleaner code than web forms was. But then again, I hated web forms on site, even before I cared about OO purity or TDD or anything like that. It's something about web forms just violates my aesthetics.
So the flip side of this MVC stuff is, you know, Microsoft has their MVC framework now, and there's some group of people who will always say, well, it's from Microsoft, so we should use their stuff. You know, why should we go out and use this sort of open sourcey, not from Microsoft framework for building our apps? What, you know, what would you say to those people? What are the really compelling, you know, benefits that sort of override that it's from Microsoft sort of default that people have?
I'd like to weigh in on this one. I don't know if I would necessarily, I'm certainly not, I don't know how Jeremy feels about this, but I'm certainly not positioning this as any sort of like competitor or against ASP.NET MVC. I mean, they do kind of take two different tacks to the same problem. And I think if you're using either one of them, say over web forms, you're going to be in a much better position, you know, and I think if you're open and you're in a position where you can choose frameworks like this and you're not in, you know, a very large corporation where they have very strict policies on, say, using open source software. If you're in a small shop, I would posit that it's you can get started quicker with FUBU MVC and Fluent and Hibernate if you're familiar with some of these patterns. If you're not, it may be a little harder to get going. There's certainly not as much documentation and there's not as large a community yet, hopefully. I don't know, but I doubt it will ever be anywhere near. So, you know, there's like comfort levels, how familiar you are with the patterns. If you know these sorts of things and you're already familiar with them and you're open to using new types of frameworks, I would definitely encourage you to check out FUBU MVC. But if you're in some big large corporation and they're using, you know, third-party web form controls and major, you know, the huge data grid control that everybody produces and, you know, I would probably not recommend you go to FUBU MVC, at least right off the start. You know, you might check out ASP.NET MVC because I think you're gonna be a lot happier with that. You're gonna lose the control support, but I did want to make one quick point about moving to MVC in general. One of the big things I keep hearing, people still keep talking about this, is haven't we just gone back to ASP? And my argument for that, I want to put in here, take this opportunity you've given me this microphone, to say that we've gone back to some of the good stuff of ASP. So the main problem with ASP is, one, you were working with a VB script. You were working with a dynamic language that was kind of not so great as a dynamic language, so you didn't get any of the support for that. And two, there was no view logic separation. There was tons of logic in the view, which is just a bad pattern in general. So you can have the benefit and the control of ASP, but without all the maintenance problems that ASP cause, because you're dealing with a grown-up language and you're using view logic separation of concerns and all that sort of thing, and you're going about it in a grown-up way, and so you can avoid some of those pains.
One thing I would say, and an important point for people moving from web forms to MVC, and then I'd like to make a small point of FUBU versus ASP.NET MVC. Web forms versus the MVC pattern in general, so I'm lumping monorail and FUBU and ASP.NET MVC in here too. It's the sharp tools versus safety argument. WebForms tries to do everything for you, and it's not the easiest thing in the world to customize yourself. So it's awesome that it does all that stuff, lots of stuff, drag and drop controls, but the MVC is a sharp tool. It's very easy to customize for yourself if you're willing to get dirty and basically to think for yourself and create your own guidance and tooling. It's very simple to build like our custom expressions, our custom controllers, because the lifecycle is so much simpler than web forms. You can do your own thing and get a lot of advantage out of it. You can build project, team, organization specific stuff that's going to make you go faster, but you've got to be able to apply some design skills and some thought to it. It's not coming out of the box. So in terms of comparing FUBU MVC to ASP.NET MVC, I think where FUBU is going to have maybe even a large advantage is that we're going to build in opinions right off the bat. We are going for the Rails model of taking choices away from you almost. If you walk up to FUBU, it's going to say you should use a strongly typed model all the time for your controller actions. And if you do, you're going to get all this other benefits out of it. This is the way we want you to do configuration. This is the way we want you to do to organize views. This is how we want to express text boxes. All that stuff that's in there is basically guidance. It's almost software factory stuff. It's going to help a team get started. If you go to the ASP.NET MVC, well, which it's inevitably going to have better support, tons of rocks books, and technical writers galore. The problem with ASP.NET MVC, and where I think Microsoft is missing a huge opportunity, is they're not making it opinionated. It's general. You know, I guess it has to serve lots of different people. But what that means is when you pick it up, you pretty well have to figure it out for yourself. You have to create your own conventions and how we're going to do things, because it doesn't have any particular opinion on what you should do. So I don't think the FUBU MVC is going to have a very large adoption at all. But the people who are willing to work within its constraints, and those are purposeful constraints, they're going to be able to go faster, I think. And the other advantage of FUBU MVC, and that's kind of unfair, there's simply more smart people outside of Microsoft in the community than there can ever possibly be on the Redmond campus. That's one thing. And another is FUBU MVC can make very liberal use of open source tooling, where I don't think Microsoft really can. I mean, the jQuery thing was huge. They have a little bit of InUnit and MBUnit stuff, but we can use IOC containers. We can use it in Hibernate. We can use every possible open source tool in the world, and that's a huge advantage.
I'm curious whether you guys are looking at or thinking about any sort of tooling support, like ASP.NET MVC has some Visual Studio projects, and Visual Studio, add-in isn't the right word, but sort of GUI enhancements for easily adding views and adding controllers and strongly typed views and that sort of stuff. And I'm wondering if that's on your on your horizon.
I personally think that would be an awesome contribution if somebody actually knows how to use the T4 templating, and they would contact Chad, and we could turn them loose on that. I don't know how to do that stuff. I think that would be cool. The one thing I desperately don't want to see, though, is I don't ever want to see a custom project type. Nothing irritates me more than downloading open source code or something that's supposed to be open source and it has some kind of project type you don't have loaded on your box. Anyway, maybe that's not important, but I hate that.
One of the things that I have been thinking about, I know we've talked to Jeremy and I have talked about this before, is, you know, having some scaffolding similar to Rails where I can say, you know, I want a new controller, and then it would somehow respect your conventions, put the controller in the right place with the right namespace, and, you know, add some, create a test harness for it, you know, that's ready to go for you to start test driving your actions, you know, way to add behaviors. Since the configuration is very conventional, it's not clear every time what exactly is going to happen when a request comes in. It's usually pretty straightforward if you keep things simple, but I can't imagine that on larger projects it you could get disassociated from, okay, now how does this action get called again? So the semantic model's all there. You can pass a visitor down through it and inspect it. And one of the things, actually, I'm looking at my notebook here, it's actually on my list, is to be able to, you know, have like what if scenarios. You know, so here's a URL, what's going to happen? Show me what would happen. Okay, you know, this behavior is going to fire, then this one, then this one, then this one, then the action's going to get called, and then there's some post-action behavior stuff that's going on, and then eventually it's going to render this view, and here's the file path to the view that it would render, and here's a dump of the view model that it would have passed to the, you know, that sort of thing. So you can either do prototype, or you can actually do a live tracer round through the system where it actually would go and hit the database and pull stuff. So I think that would be pretty cool, you know, those sorts of, have scaffolding and be able to, you know, really kind of explore through. So you get all the benefits of convention without having to give up your visibility.
The visibility is a good point. One of the things we can do in Dovetail, and I don't know if it's wandered into FUBU, is we can run a report that'll tell you every possible route. You know, what are the parameters of the route? What controller action does that go to? And then how does it get handled on the back end? You know, does it go to this view? Is it intercepted to this mobile view? You know, whatnot. And that's an awesome thing. But when we get into these convention-based frameworks or any framework that uses tons of attributes to wire things together, there's always a little bit of an element of what the hell is going on in there. So you have to come back with some kind of diagnostics to say, well, this is what should happen. And I say this in part to kind of poke at the MEF team. I think MEF is going to have a huge problem with this unless they have very solid diagnostics.
You know, there's some sort of very foundational sort of issues that go along with building any sort of web framework around scalability, partial trust support, security, thread safety, caching, output caching, all that sort of stuff. You know, where are you guys at in that sort of, you know, life cycle of the project? Is it, you know, is still a lot of work that's needed to sort of explore those areas? Have you done any work in that area?
At least with FUBU, the goal is to try to stay as far away from that kind of stuff as possible and utilize ASP.NET to the fullest extent. ASP.NET actually has a lot of these problems solved. You know, it has a good caching system that we can rely on. You know, so we're trying to, you know, let me be clear, we're not using ASP.NET MVC, but we are using the ASP.NET platform, for lack of a better term, you know, system, a lot of stuff in the system.web, just not system.web.page or system.web.control that much. So there's a lot of good stuff in ASP.NET, and it's actually a pretty good platform. It runs, I think it runs Facebook and MySpace and Dell.com. That's nothing to shake a stick at. So we want to try to leverage that much as possible and just try to keep the framework as just directing things to controllers, you know, and leave all the response and request handling, you know, as much a part of ASP.NET as possible. So, but there still are security concerns. There's still strings that, you know, you could have cross-site scripting problems, you know, so by keeping controllers small and, you know, trying to keep things in the views a part of these expressions, you know, where the expressions are building up things, we can centralize some of those problems. So, you know, anywhere where a property, like when you're rendering a text box, or you're rendering a label, you know, just a body of text in a pre or a span or a div or something like that, you know, use these expressions and you can centralize the sort of HTML encoding and URL encoding type stuff. You know, I don't think any framework's ever going to fully solve those, but, you know, you can take steps to mitigate those by keeping your hot points centralized.
Now, with the caching, I think with us, with FUBU, by keeping the controller lifecycle very hackable, you know, the way you're assembling, you know, I have this controller action and it's handled by this stuff. I think I hope it'll give us the ability to put caching in at almost any level. You know, you could cache the model object itself. You could cache the HTML. We should be able to do partial rendering more or less the way it is. But yeah, there's tons of work to do. The stuff like the cross site scripting and security failures, it's kind of like using parameterized SQL to some degree. You know, by being aggressive with master pages or the text box expression type stuff, any place where you need to be safe, just by trying to go dry and eliminating the duplication, I think you can reduce the risk, at least, or we could reduce the risk once we get around to it.
Because the behavior support, because it's so configurable, it would be pretty easy to add behaviors. You can even add behaviors at runtime if you wanted to, but you could, you know, if running in a debug mode, you can add a couple extra behaviors that check the output for, you know, you can make a declaration in your application, like nothing goes to the view that hasn't already been sanitized by a behavior. So you can have like the last behavior that fires before the view gets called would be, you know, just check every string property or any string anywhere in the view model. If it has, you know, a tag, an HTML tag or something in it, then, you know, fail the request. So you could run this in a test mode. So you do have some options there. I think just keeping the configuration loose and keeping the framework as much out of that business as possible, it kind of forces those issues to the top where you can address them more forthrightly instead of, you know, being buried in a control somewhere.
Well, just being able, just by having composed and, you know, everything fulfills one role and one role only, it's going to give us the ability to put, you know, like a caching decorator around the controller. So without changing the controller or anything else, the caching can get data out of here or there or something else without really changing FUBU infrastructure at all.
All right, one more question. When Joe.NET developer pulls this down from Google code, they might see something that is not familiar, which is the rake file in the solution. Could you explain what that is real quick?
So rake is, if you're familiar with NAT or MS Build, rake is the equivalent from the Ruby world, with the advantage being rake is all scripted in Ruby. It's effectively an internal DSL for doing builds. It turns out to be pretty easy to use for .NET projects. I mean, you just shell out to MS Build for compile and unit for testing. But because you're writing in Ruby, So anything you need to script or any kind of conditional logic, if you'll remember or can picture how nasty that gets in NAT files, rake becomes much easier to maintain, read, extend than trying to code in XML for MS Build or NAT. So we have a template for a rake template for .NET. So it's to the point where, for us at least, setting up a rake script for a .NET project is actually faster for us than using NAT right now. But to be honest, I started using rake a couple projects ago for us just as an excuse to play with Ruby, and it turned out we liked it and kept it.
Just FYI, if you're interested in getting started in rake, both Fluent and Hibernate and Fubu MVC have the kind of the bootstrapper build util stuff for building .NET projects that, you know, can call out to NUnit and call out to MS Build to compile the solution and stuff. And so several people have asked about that, actually, and I think it's starting to get out there. So at some point, we should probably consolidate that into some central source repository somewhere, because, you know, make it its own project, because it seems to be catching on.
I think we should just keep copying it. Yeah.
Yeah. That we've reflection got, helper. Yeah.
Yeah. We have a class called Reflection Helper. And between Chad and I think we've copied it into 5 or 6 different OSS projects. But it's a little bit different everywhere.
I want to thank Jeremy and Chad for coming on the show and talking to us about Fubu MVC and all these great patterns and ideas that they have put into place. So we encourage everyone to download that and check out their work. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right.